Thank you, Mr. Anthony. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming out an hour early in order to permit me to discharge some of my other duties. It so happened that the date for the spectacular had to be changed a couple of times because of the facilities in certain states. And it finally turned out to be on the same night that I was scheduled to be here with you. But the lecture series was kind enough to advance it from 8:30 to 7:30. And I hope it has not inconvenienced a great many of you. And I certainly assure you that it is deeply appreciated by me and by those of us who are working so hard on this television show. I might add, because I will not have an opportunity during the lecture, that the bail bond money is rather unspectacular but very necessary. We are now paying out about $5,000 a week in bond money on appeal bonds for cases whose principals were arrested in Mississippi last summer. Last summer, we put up $500 apiece for their bail, and when their cases were heard this winter, they were found guilty, of course, and if they desire to appeal, we must post another bond of $1,000 for each appeal, so that this has been averaging about $5,000 a week. And this is a considerable amount of money. Last year, in Mississippi alone, we put out $240,000 in cash bond money the whole year. So that tonight's spectacular is vitally necessary, and you can understand that when I found out that Liz Taylor and Richard Burton had unexpectedly consented to appear, I raised no questions of moral turpitude. Especially since the ticket sales immediately began to go up, thus proving that the great American public took the same, well, shall we say, philosophical view of the situation that I took. 3 days from now will mark the 10th anniversary of the United States Supreme Court ruling of May 17, 1954, which declared unconstitutional the practice of racial segregation in the public schools. The tense racial situation this spring, which has become the greatest civil rights crisis since the Civil War, is the direct result of the refusal of America to put the 1954 ruling into effect. And if the nation continues to play with this ruling as though it were a zoning ordinance to be settled upon at some undefined future moment, we are certain to have no peace on the racial front. It is possible that we may have the worst kind of violence, the kind based senselessly but hotly upon race and color. This is no threat, but a sober conclusion resting solidly upon the epical nature of the 1954 decision in Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, which is the technical name of the 1954 decision. If you may or may not remember, there were five cases decided by the Supreme Court on this question, and they were arranged, as is customary, in alphabetical order. And therefore, the case of Topeka, Kansas, whose plaintiff was named Brown, came first. And after the manner of lawyers and courts and our whole system of legal jurisprudence, They named these series of cases Brown et al. Versus certification of Kansas et al., which means, if my translators have given me the correct information, and I can't translate it myself, that this is the first of a series of cases of which Brown is one of the plaintiffs against boards of education, of which Topeka, Kansas is one of the defendants. Anyone who reads the Brown decision as merely an adjudication of a school dispute is in error. The ruling is a reaffirmation of the citizenship status of Negro Americans. It brings them fully under the guarantees of the Constitution of the United States. It abolishes the old concept of separate but equal constitutionality established by the 1896 ruling in the case of Plessy versus Ferguson. And this you may remember as the ruling in which the Supreme Court, by a vote of 8-1, Mr. Justice Harlan, being the lone dissenter in 1896. And I won't bother you with all of Mr. Harlan's dissent, the most famous line of which is that the Constitution must be colorblind. But I call your attention to only his last paragraph and the gist of it, which was that if these laws should be passed, namely segregation laws such as the one that Plessy was arrested under in Louisiana, which was a railroad segregation car case. Mr. Justice Harlan said, if laws of like nature should be passed by the several states, it would be very mischievous and would be practically returned to slavery, and it would pass upon the civil rights of all of us, common to all of us, on the basis of race and color, and significantly, he said, it would place in a condition of legal inferiority a great body of American citizens. Well, Brown overturned Plessy, and Brown restores to Negro citizens those rights under the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which should have been freely enjoyed by them beginning about 1870, when the last amendment was adopted. It restates the principle that there is no constitutional sanction for laws, local, state, or federal, which differentiate between citizens of the United States on the basis of race or color. Now, if this basic aspect of the Brown ruling is understood, then the deep feelings of the Negro population become understandable. The upheavals and upsurges become significant, and the prediction of continued racial unrest becomes credible. For what is involved here is much more than the number of Negro children integrated into a school system hitherto racially segregated, important as that is. The root disturbance is to be found in the defiance of the citizenship and human equality doctrine enunciated by Brown. This is what has stirred and angered the Negro community. This is what has sent its youth surging into the streets and overflowing into the jails. This is what has rallied the adults into a united as never before financial and psychological army behind the young frontline demonstrators. This is what has produced the incredible sacrifices, the jailings, the delayed careers, the beatings and other maltreatments, the losses of jobs, homes, farms, the bombings and killings. It is this that has aroused the conscience of that part of white America that still has a conscience and has drawn a vast number of its churches and its clear-eyed college youth into the crusade for individual freedom. And it ought to be said right here that one of the important aspects of the present crusade has been the activity of the churches of all three major faiths, Protestant, the Catholic, and the Jewish, and side by side with those churches, if not out in front of them slightly, have been the college white students who have heard the call and the challenge of this present-day civil rights crusade and have thrown themselves into it with enthusiasm and tenacity and skill and sacrifice. Emphasis upon this major aspect, the aspect of the denial of citizenship rights, does not discount the shame and the callous inadequacy of the implementation thus far of the 1954 decision. In 11 states regarded as southern, as distinguished from border states, the 10-year average percentage of Negroes in public school with whites is 1/600%. At the top, if you call it a top, of this list is Texas, with an average of 4.29%. And at the bottom is, of course, guess who? Mississippi, with no percent. The only others with an average of more than 1% for the 10-year period are Tennessee, 2/7100%, Virginia, 1/5700%, and Florida, 1/5300%. Arkansas is just under 1% with 0.968. The advanced state in race relations, North Carolina, musters barely more than 0.5% as a result of her effort over a decade. Louisiana, which never pretended to be liberal on this issue and whose legislature fought desegregation dirty tooth and dirty claw, in contrast to North Carolina's correctly behaved legislature, nevertheless shows up, if we may use this phrase in referring to minuscule matters, the Tar Heel state with a percentage of 0.602. Now, six border states and the District of Columbia have a 10-year average of 56.2% of Negroes in school with whites, ranging from 87.9 in West Virginia to 28.1 in Oklahoma. Now, the overall average of southern and border states is 9.3%, less than 1% a year for the decade 54 to 64. If this disgraceful rate should continue, it would require more than 100 years to effectuate the Brown decision. Yet the segregationists shout that this pace is going too fast and pushing too hard, and that if the Negro persists in this pell-mell drive, he will lose his friends and alienate those who would be his friends. Well, obviously, Negro Americans now in the 101st year of the issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation are not going to wait 100 years for their constitutional rights to be acknowledged and accorded them throughout the land. Any public official who still believes, after these years of direct action and after continued legal assault upon the remaining bastions embodied in laws and legal subterfuges, that Negro citizens are happy and satisfied and that only a few agitators are involved, is in for some jarring realism. The resentment of the Negro community is sparked, of course, by the Southern statistics on school desegregation. The people realize full well that each year of deprivation of Negro children weakens and cripples the Negro generations of the future. Their resentment is fed also by the artful dodges and the bald defiance uncovered in many northern cities, where de facto school segregation is being combated. Negro citizens are spurred as well to protest action, to hot words, and to frustrating beating-on-the-wall demonstrations by a wide range of discrimination in employment, in housing, in voting, in public accommodations, and in other segments of American life. I know I do not have to recall for this audience here in New York City the demonstration of white plumbers, members of the plumbers union, walking off the job when Puerto Ricans and a lone Negro were hired by a contractor building the new Bronx market. And I'm sure I do not have to only have to recall for you that out in California, in the aspect of housing, California passed a fair housing law, and the real estate interests are there busy spurring an initiative not only to recall the law and get rid of it, but carrying the proviso that hereafter no municipality and no legislature, that includes the state assembly, shall pass any kind of law restricting the freedom of a man to buy and sell his property as he sees fit. In other words, the California bigots not only want to recall the fair housing law that already has been enacted, but they want to be certain that no other kinds of fair housing laws, municipal or state, shall be enacted, and that discrimination in housing shall thus be free of any restraint. In the matter of voting, I call your attention to the announcement just the other day that some 2 million Negroes are now registered in the South, whereas there should be about 5 million registered. But the 2 million represents an increase from 1,300,000, so that the increase since 1960 has been about between 600 and 700,000, largely due to intensified drives there to secure registration in some of the larger urban areas. As far as schools are concerned, I point out to you that in that citadel of culture, Rock Rib, Boston, where the ambassador to Vietnam has only to announce his name in order to be nominated in the New England primary. In Boston, it was discovered through a little research that the schools in the Negro neighborhoods, Roxbury and surrounding areas, that the children had less spent on them per capita from the rest of the Boston schools, that their graduates fail more often in the citywide tests than those from other schools, and that the schools themselves form the majority of the oldest schools in the Boston system. Now, if this is true in Boston in 1963, you can imagine of what is true here in New York and in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and Cleveland and Detroit and other northern cities. And you can understand why the NAACP has action going, either of a community or a legal nature, in 80 cities in 15 states in the North in the matter of de facto school segregation. But my friends, the sustenance for these separate protests and the link which binds New York employment pickets to California housing campaigners, to Boston school boycotters, to Nashville restaurant pickets, to Mississippi voter registration workers, is the common conviction that their citizenship is at stake. They believe deeply that racial differentiation by their government, local, state, and federal, as expressed in laws and customs in defiance of the Brown Doctrine, is an affront to them as members of the human family. They feel they can make no acknowledgement of this practice, however temporary. They feel they cannot remain silent or inactive when the disciples and practitioners of the life decreed for them under the discredited separate but equal citizenship doctrine seeks to perpetuate it in the 1960s. They want no more of what Justice Harlan called the status of legal inferiority. Thus, even the taciturn and the normally cautious ones enter audible demurs to the continuance of the old order. It must be emphasized that on this point of common and equal citizenship and on common humanity, there is no division whatsoever within the Negro population of this country. although there is, and well may continue to be, a difference of opinion and difference between certain Negro organizations as to timing, as to methods, as to strategy. But these organizations, which have met informally since February 1963, on an average of 4 to 5 weeks apart, in which they exchange views and take tally on what is being done, these organizations do not differ at all on the goals that they seek. It is for this reason that the Civil Rights Bill now pending in the United States Senate has aroused hope, but hope accompanied by large doses of cynicism and despair. This bill, requested originally by President John F. Kennedy in June 1963 and endorsed fully and repeatedly by President Lyndon B. Johnson, was passed by the House of Representatives on February 10, 1964 by an overwhelming bipartisan vote of 290-130. A total of 138 Republicans, led by Representative William McCullough of Ohio and by a minority leader, the Republican minority leader, Representative Charles Halleck of Indiana, joined 152 Democrats in passing the House bill. The Democratic floor leader was Representative Emanuel Seller of New York. Now, the Senate has had this bill since March 9, 1964. It spent weeks after that date discussing whether the bill should be taken up at all as the official business. It has spent weeks since that decision debating the bill itself. It has spent 3 weeks alone discussing one amendment having to do with jury trials in contempt cases. And yesterday, Senator Richard B. Russell of Georgia, the leader of the 19 Southern senators who were filibustering and preventing the 81 other senators from voting on the bill, announced arrogantly that he would not permit a vote on the jury trial amendment until next week. Now, since there are several pending amendments of this nature, the whole of next week could be taken up with this one item. For Negro citizens, this Senate discussion and delay, accompanied by intolerable arguments on the racial situation and the relationship of the federal government to it, has been a humiliating experience. It is galling to have one's rights as a citizen debated as though the Senate were discussing the eligibility of a Tasmanian to the rights and privileges of United States citizenship. In truth, it is not at all far-fetched to assert that a Tasmanian would have an easier time securing full American citizenship rights than a 10th-generation American Negro. The Senate is listening to the technicalities, to hair splitting, and to lies such as the one linking the Civil Rights Bill to a communist, but not a fascist, police state. Negro Americans who have slaved and worked for this country, who have defended and died for it in every year, in every war it has fought, whose faith has withstood lynchings and persecution and cruel inequalities across the whole spectrum of life, are forced to hear once more from the highest deliberative body the old slanders and the old degrading proposals. It is contended, for example, once more, that the Constitution never contemplated them, the Negroes, that the Supreme Court was doing the bidding of international communism in its Brown decision, and that the Senate must not acquiesce in this recognition of subhumans as humans. It must not permit the government of the United States through a civil rights law to interfere in the status and treatment of the Negroes as determined by those states which came to such wealth and power as they now enjoy on the slave backs of the grandfathers, grandmothers, and great-grandfathers and great-grandmothers of the present-day petitioners. The federal power, the argument goes, must not be invoked here. The right of a public business to select white customers as against black must not be curtailed or forbidden. the right of an employer and of unions to exclude and starve Negro wage earners and family heads must remain inviolate as far as Senate action is concerned. The Negro must fight his way to the ballot box through the antebellum obstacle courses erected by the beneficiaries of the lily-white exclusionist system and undisturbed by senators who sit in that chamber only because their black residents are barred from voting. There is a pause now in the alleged deliberations while an effort is made to agree upon amending language that will permit some non-Southern senators to vote to shut off debate and to get on with the business of the United States. Thus, it appears that in addition to Senator Russell and his cabal, the Negro citizens must give a password of some sort to some of the senators in the party that came into being on an anti-slavery platform. The stalwart Republican senators who have supported this type of legislation and stronger year in and year out must join their fellow Negro citizens in shame that in 1960 some of their party colleagues should be debating human rights. Yesterday it was announced that agreement had been reached on some of these amendments, but late this afternoon the conferees in the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights issued the following statement. Our preliminary study indicates that some proposals would weaken the measure and result in unnecessary delay in enforcement. A line-by-line analysis of each proposal must be made before a final decision can be reached. We appreciate the efforts of our friends in the Senate to explore every possible avenue toward prompt passage of this bill, and every proposal they make will be carefully weighed by us. But this point must be made crystal clear. We do not intend to compromise our principles. We insist on passage of a measure which will be meaningful, enforceable, and just, and which will provide speedy relief from today's intolerable situation. This statement is made in the absence of the exact texts. You know, these agreements reached in the Senate take 24 to 48 to 60 hours to get an exact text, the exact language, so that this statement was issued in the absence of having what Mr. Dirksen and Mr. Humphrey and Mr. Kennedy agreed upon yesterday, if they did agree. In this discussion of the Civil Rights Bill, the crowning something or other was given 2 days ago in a Madison Square Garden speech by Senator Barry Goldwater, leading candidate for the Republican nomination for President of the United States. In a distortion which has to be deliberate, he declared, "You can't pass a law that will make me like you or you like me." End of quotation. The pending Civil Rights Bill does not seek to force anyone to like anyone else. It seeks to secure the elementary rights to which every American citizen is entitled, whether anyone loves him or not. And whether he intends it or not, Senator Goldwater's position of leaving civil rights matters to the states grants immunity to the issue, to the use of cattle prods and shotguns by Alabama state troopers, the armored tank and dogs and fire hoses of Birmingham police, the bomb murderers of little children in church in Alabama, and the assassin of Medgar Evers in Jackson, Mississippi last June. Negro citizens will not return to this 1896-1954 pattern of life. If their pleas continue to be met with sophistry and Civil War oratory, there will certainly be violence in the streets and elsewhere. Nothing else will be left. There will be nowhere to turn. The Negro will be forced back upon his own resources. The frustrated ones, the outraged ones, the ones whose sole strategy is blind battle against any and all, will win recruits from among the disillusioned, polarization on color alone will increase, with whites against blacks and blacks against whites, and no grays in between. To permit this to happen would be folly of the worst sort, especially since the price of respect and progress is simply justice and compassion. More than Negro-white relations is at stake. On trial is the basic question of whether Western democratic society can do justice to Negro and white citizens of a country established by a Declaration of Independence that declares all men to be equal before the law. Not all white men, not all black men, but all men. If this is not to be for Negro Americans, we will come sooner or later to a place where it will not obtain for other Americans. The concept of individual freedom and justice under law will go down the drain. Now, in the present contest, the segregationists have turned from action to block segregation itself to action to block petitions for desegregation. And these include legislation such as the Civil Rights Bill. They have trampled upon freedom of speech and assembly, upon the right of petition for redress of grievances. The battle is now pitched on that level, a level openly posing the problem not of racial rights, but of the survival of a free society. In his immortal Gettysburg Address, Abraham Lincoln called for a resolution that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom. Now, Lincoln did not mean freedom for individual states to go their various ways. He was fighting a war against that. Nor did he mean freedom for the Negro alone. He meant, of course, freedom for a nation, for the composite whole and all the people thereof. The crisis today is only incidentally a Negro crisis. It is a crisis of national life and, in a very deep and real sense, a sense sharpened by the turn of history in which we find ourselves, it is a crisis of free men in our century. The resolution with which we meet it, burying racism and regionalism and burying the political shenanigans inherent in the states' rights system, could determine whether freedom or a type of slavery shall be the lot of men of every color, everywhere. Thank you.